This episode is sponsored by Transcend, a veteran-owned and operated performance optimization company that I introduced recently as a sponsor on this show. Well, since then, I have actually been using my products and I've had incredible success. There was initial blood work that was extremely detailed, and based on that, they offered supplementation. So I began taking DHEA, BPC-157 for inflammation, based on the fact that I've been a stuntman, a martial artist, and a firefighter my whole life, lots of aches and pains, Dihexa to help cognition after multiple punches to the head and shift work, and peptides. 4 months later, they did a detailed blood work again, and I was actually able to taper off two of the peptides because my body had responded so well to just one of them that it was optimized at that point. So I cannot speak highly enough of the immense range of supplementation that they offer, whether it's male health, female health, peptides to boost your own testosterone, which I would argue is needed by a lot of the fire service, or whether it's exogenous testosterone needed, especially after TBIs or advanced age. Now, as I mentioned before, the other side of this company is an altruistic arm called the Transcend Foundation, which is putting veterans and first responders through some of their protocols free of charge. Now, Transcend are also offering you, the audience, 10% off their protocols. And you can find that on jamesgearing.com under the products tab. And if you want to hear more about Transcend and their story, listen to episode 808 with the founder, Ernie Colling, or go to transcendcompany.com. This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself, who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes, and there are several features that really impressed me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think, teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week I have an incredibly interesting guest for you. Chris Cameron is a helicopter pilot that works with law enforcement. He is an adventurer, a rescue swimmer, and he leads dives with sharks. So I would argue one of the most interesting people I have had to interview as far as the broad skill set of the individual. So in this powerful conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from some of the career saves through the helicopter pilot's view, the incredibly unique experience the divers get when they go on his shark expeditions, mental health, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Chris Cameron. Enjoy.
Well, Chris, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to Drew Nicoletti, our mutual friend, for making the connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you very much, man. I'm privileged to be here.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
West Palm Beach, Florida at the moment. Yeah, right here at the airport, actually. So I've got the rest of the crew handling calls. So I stepped away for a second just to touch base, because this was definitely worth the time. I think it's an incredible opportunity just to talk about, you know, what we face as first responders, and just life outside of that too, which is something I'm super passionate about.
Absolutely. I'm actually going to be down your way. My wife graduates from Nova Southeastern as a doctor of optometry next week.
I could throw a rock. Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah, no, thank you. Four years she was actually away from home, or 3.5 technically. So it's been the test of our marriage in a good way, because it survived just fine, but it was a lot. All right. Well, I'd love to start at the very beginning of your timeline. So tell me where you were born, and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Yeah. So I'm a third generation Floridian, which I guess is rare enough in itself these days. Usually everybody's a transplant, but families from here, generations before me, my family was all cattle ranchers in the middle of the state. And then they kind of trickled down to South Florida. And that's where I guess I step into the picture. My dad, person family, two older sisters. So I was the youngest boy that they would probably argue got born with a silver spoon in his mouth. but that's what siblings do, right? My dad, also a Florida native, he went to the University of Florida, played football there, then was drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals, played 11 seasons in the NFL for the Cincinnati Bengals. And then after that, came back to South Florida and started practicing law. Did some agent work right out of the NFL, and did some stuff with some players, and then moved on and opened up his own practice. And then that's where I kind of stepped into the picture. I was the last one to be born, and closing off the full family dynamic. So family's been here ever since. And this is where I grew up, my backyard. South Florida is an incredible place, because you can do just about anything here. If I go 15 minutes that way, I'm in the Everglades, I'm in horse country. If I go 15 minutes that way, I'm in beautiful Gulf Stream blue waters. So my time was just growing up split between being out in the wild. Well, I guess being out in the wild, no matter what direction it was, but being in the Everglades or being out on the ocean. And grew up here outdoors my whole life. And then left for 4 years, went to Mississippi State University, played football there. And then after that, got right into my professional flying career as soon as college was over, and came back to South Florida. So pretty straightforward, not a lot of twists and turns down the path. I was one of those kids, I just knew what I wanted to do since I was probably 8 years old. I wanted to play football as long as I could and fly. A couple of grandparents that were aces in World War II. So it was, I saw what my dad did, wanted to do that. I heard the stories of what my grandparents did, wanted to do that. And then just kind of was able to tie it all together in life. So that's the current status.
Well, let's go all the way back to grandparents, because this is something I've had so many conversations with recently. We have this romanticization of that generation. And of course, what they did, no one can argue. Absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. But I think where the erroneous romanticization comes in is, well, they just came home, they rolled up the sleeves, and they just got on with it, and they were fine. But then you hear all these grandfather stories, and you're like, some of them weren't fine. Just the same way as some of our vets, some of our first responders aren't fine at the moment. You know, and that's a natural reaction to the horrors that they had to endure. And then arguably the childhood they had prior to putting on uniform. So when you reflect, what were some of the powerful combat stories that you heard, if any? And then do you now, with this kind of mental health lens, see any of the trauma of war on your grandparents?
Sure. I think the most thing that I was affected by hearing about it growing up was their age, doing what they did, flying in a world war at 20 years old. 19 in some cases, that is pretty astounding, because I didn't start flying professionally and in law enforcement until I was, you know, into my late 20s. So mid to late 20s. So, and those couple of years, I think, make a huge formative difference. So I think that's something that always just kept me awestruck when I was younger, just thinking about what they were able to process, or in some cases, maybe not process, just because you are young and you are just kind of living day by day, you're able to accomplish and do the things that they did. So I think that's always been first and foremost kind of what stuck out to me in my mind. And then looking back on it through the lens that I have now, their ability, I know we're doing it differently now. We're having these conversations and we're talking about these things and talking about the pressures of the job or the things that you see and the things that you experience. But they did. They just came back home, and whether they had each other in their group of friends or their, you know, fellow men and women at arms that they spoke to about it, those conversations I've never been privy to, but it always seemed like they just rolled up their sleeves and moved on to the next thing. Just this impressive commitment to duty. And I think when my grandparents came back, it was right into the family life. And it's unfortunate, you know, they're both passed now, and I wasn't old enough to dig into that and have those conversations with them. I just caught the romanticized version of it and was just impressed by it at such a young age. And I think probably nature and nurture that kind of steered me down the path that I'm on, for sure. But I wish I had that time to have those conversations and really get into what they were feeling, what they were thinking, what the pressures were of coming home, to an environment like that, so starkly different from what they experienced.
Yeah. I mean, when you look back at the generation prior, obviously it was the Great Depression. So they, you know, some of these families were definitely hardened by discomfort a lot more than arguably we are. Yeah. But yeah, when you listen to these grandfather stories, a lot of times there was alcoholism, there was domestic abuse, there was a lot of things mm-hmm. that we still see today, because they were yeah. human beings, you know, first, and then maybe a little bit tougher, maybe a little bit more resilient, but still human beings. So some people obviously yeah. processed it well. You know, Dick Winters mm-hmm. is a good example from the 101st. You know, he wrote a whole book yeah. and he seemed to retain, you know, the ability to lead and the ability to move forward. But I think a lot of people suffered in silence as well, and we just kind of brushed over them as a culture.
Yeah, I know from my experience with my father and speaking with him, the word that he would describe his father as, it was always this stoicism. There was just this steady stoicism that I think was a product, a byproduct of that environment that he came out of. And it wasn't so much that he was always intimidated by him, but there was just a heaviness, and that was prevalent throughout the rest of his life.
Absolutely. Well, I just had an interview with Danny Alvarez, who's one of our state representatives in the kind of Tampa area. And he was mm-hmm. one of the bills he was pushing was to actually help farmers in the state of Florida, I think especially the cattle farmers. And I didn't realize yeah. how prevalent that was as a state.
Mm-hmm. Huge.
Talk yeah. to me about the beautiful things about the cattle farming that you've experienced, and what are the challenges that Florida farmers are facing?
I think obviously there's the urban squeeze, right? Especially over the last couple of years with COVID and different states making policy changes, Florida has exploded. It's always been on the rise, but it has been ramped up completely. Florida for a very long time, I think it still holds the title. It's the number one calving producer of the United States. So in the cattle and beef industry, cattle is raised here from its infancy. And then once they're born and raised up a little bit, then they're shipped off, usually out west, for beef production. But the process starts here. And I think the biggest thing that a lot of agriculture faces is just, especially with Florida being surrounded by water on all sides, you've just got this urban sprawl that just squeezes the middle of the state. It's still sustainable for now, but it will be an issue. But it definitely, I went up during my youth to Ocala in Gainesville and had family that had farms and ranches. And there was a very, very beautiful simplicity and to the lifestyle up there. And it's everything, not to sound cliche, but it's everything that you would hear in a country song or just life is who you're with and what you're doing. And and that's enough. And it's hard work. They were grueling summers when I was up there. It's like I have like these fond memories of it, but then I really dig in and I think about how much I wanted to be back on the coast, you know, out on a boat. I get a little, can come back to reality, but it was an incredible experience. It taught me hard work, what it is to wake up when the sun comes up, work all day, and really be hungry for dinner at the end of the day. I go home now and, you know, I'll eat a little bit and go to bed, but those were like ravenous days where as soon as you sit down at the dinner table, you inhale everything in front of you and then you go to sleep and wake up and do it all again. So it was a beautiful time, man. They're really fond memories.
Well, I live in Ocala and I've seen a lot of our horse farms just be completely decimated and turned into housing. And let me not be a hypocrite. I'm sitting in a house on a farm. Right. So, you know, I'm part of the problem. But, you know, the villages now is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we're losing all that land between Orlando and Ocala as well. So, you know, there has to be a line in the sand. I mean, at some point, you've got to say enough is enough and retain the very beauty that Florida has before it becomes a concrete jungle.
Yeah, that was the essence of it for sure. I don't think it's never been the same after air conditioning was invented. It would have stayed the same had air conditioning not been invented.
Very true. Very, very true. All right. Well, then you mentioned about your dad's NFL career. Mm-hmm. As we sit here now, we're slowly starting to understand that the mental health side is not just the psychology, but it's the physiology. And a lot of combat athletes, contact sports, you know, the military, the CTE, the concussion-related impacts, you know, are becoming more and more prevalent and we're more aware of them now. What about that impact on your father as we sit here now?
Yeah, so my father actually participated. So he played throughout the 80s, and the game was different then. It's funny, I was probably a couple weeks ago, I showed him, I think it was like it was an old broadcast intro for the NFL, and it was like a 20-second spotlight of like, you know, the upcoming Sunday night and Monday night games. And it was this little clip, but of the 15 tackles and action shots that made up this clip, every single one of those hits is now illegal. And we were kind of joking about it. Like this, not like it was celebrated at the time. This wouldn't even fly like for a second in the league they're playing in now, for good reason, but we had a laugh about it. And he actually did participate in the Harvard study, of the brain physiology, must've been 10, 12 years ago now. What he took away and kind of the insight that he got is what they found is that the brain is very similar for whatever reason. I don't think they've pinpointed it yet, but some athletes for whatever reason will be plagued by injuries their entire career, just some type of physiology. And then others will go through an entire career, God willing, without ever breaking a bone or tweaking a muscle. And my dad was one of those very fortunate where the head trauma, I mean, he started in the NFL, played for 11, started for 9, in Super Bowl contending teams, and has really, really gotten out unscathed, from that experience, which is just extremely rare. And, they said that's kind of just a physiology lottery. And he's extremely fortunate because he's got players and teammates of his that haven't been, and he's seen the decline, and how rapid it increases. And it's heartbreaking because those were people I looked up to when I was growing up that would always be over at the house. And then as they get into their twilight years, there's, this serious drop off. So he's been very fortunate, and he's thankful for that every single day and for what, you know, his career afforded him. But it's, knowing what I know too is in the law enforcement side and seeing those kinds of injuries, it's a blessing because he's luck is the only thing that I could describe it as, and extremely extremely grateful that he's one of those small numbers that is doing fine.
That's amazing. Yeah, even with the physical injuries, now we're starting to realize that the multi-sport athletes, which a lot of your dad's generation probably were back then, not just, you know, football the whole time and summer camps and conditioning camps and travel ball and like we do to our kids now. So the multi-sport athlete actually is a lot more resilient. Now, that's not so much the brain, I'm sure, but, you know, like you said, the ability to overcome injuries, a lot of the injuries are overuse. So if you're playing a multitude of sports, it gives you this kind of universal resilience versus you're a pitcher, at 12 years
old.
Give
one skill set a break for a season, then pick up, get yourself well-rounded for sure. It definitely has its positives.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you mentioned being 15 minutes from the Everglades. When I worked for Hialeah Fire, I lived in Pembroke Pines. And at the time, I think there were only two streets between us and the Everglades at that point.
Yeah.
I know in your bio you sent me over, you talk about the interaction with apex predators. So when did that fascination with, the murderers that we have inhabiting our state begin?
Yeah, the murder logs, alligators. that started started in college. So when I would come back from Mississippi State, we'd get the month of May off before we had to be back for summer conditioning and two-a-days leading up to the season. And I grew up diving, fishing, and hunting and diving. So for cash, I went and just worked on a dive boat, and I would spearfish, as often as I could. I grew up lobstering down in the Keys. So once I started spearfishing and running chartered expeditions for the dive boats as the dive guide, as soon as I started seeing sharks regularly, it's all I wanted to see, and just kept trying to get closer and closer and closer. And I'd been in the water since I was, in wild water, either ocean or lakes and swamps, since I was 8-9 years old. That was just part of growing up here. So I just had a pull. There was that led to a career of taking people out. Not a career, but just making ends meet as a poor college kid. Taking people out and then showing them, how much closer they could get to animals and sharks and without cages, just through interactions. And then over the years through college and then after college and continuing to dive, I started to, with the rise of social media, I started to get inquiries about people, some affluent clients that were in LA or throughout the country elsewhere, where they wanted to go out and experience this in a boutique style setting, not jump on, a charter boat and go out with a bunch of other people. And I started kind of pulling this list of clients together to just showcase and put them in a one-on-one situation with whether it was tiger sharks, bull sharks, alligators in the Everglades, anything that you really, anything that could kill you, I guess, and started to put those trips together. And then eventually that kind of steamrolled into running those trips internationally. So whenever somebody wanted to see something, whether it was hammerheads, I chartered, would put together trips and guide trips in the Bahamas. I've led trips in Tahiti, in Mexico, in Guadeloupe for great white sharks. So I just started to kind of put that together, and social media certainly helps. And became recognized as somebody that could, I wouldn't say a wildlife expert, but I'm somebody who knows how to stay alive. And I think that was, stay safe and stay alive. And that was kind of the biggest draw for people that just wanted a very intimate one-on-one experience with an animal without the crowds and the splashing and all these other people. So that's kind of where that just organically grew into, and something that I still do today with a select number of people.
What did that curve look like between the first interactions with something that, if you grew up in our generation, you saw was going to murder you in a beach full of swimmers?
Yeah.
To actually developing the skill to safely close the distance between yourself and these predators.
Yeah, there was method to the madness, right? So I grew up idolizing Manny Puig, who years ago had the Ultimate Predator show. It was on Animal Planet. I think it was right after Jeff Corwin. He's a native to Miami, and was actually a friend, somebody that I met several times. And I'd seen him dive in black water on TV, and got to see him in person, interact with him. And the fear barrier, I think maybe even like we talked about earlier with, our grandparents being World War II vets, this kind of young mentality that you're a little bit indestructible, kind of just curved the edges of that. And I probably was way more lucky than I was good at what I was doing when I was out doing it by myself. But it started with just friends. The first couple of times that I did it and strapped a GoPro to myself, somebody said, "Hey, I want to go with you. I want to go with you." And And then I kind of used my friends as guinea pigs. I didn't tell them that at the time.
As bait.
But yeah. Like, hey, all right, I've kind of figured this out with me. Now, how can I figure it out with somebody over my shoulder and somebody to my left and somebody to my right? And how can I set this dive up to position myself where I'm not in their way, but if I need to be, I'm an arm's length away to intervene. And then once I started getting good at that, kind of word just spreads. And once I got those first couple of clients that are now, I consider more friend than I ever would client. You know, the first thing that people like to do at a cocktail party is bust out their phone these days and show them pictures of what they've been up to and what they've done. And that's kind of all the advertising you need in a niche little thing like this, where, you know, crazy is the identifier for, you know, getting a new person on board to come do it with you. So that's kind of how that developed.
Was there an element when you brought the first person, you say, let me see how they interact with them, that you behind your back, you had your fingers crossed, because if this goes wrong, then I'm back to the drawing board minus one person.
I'd love to say that jokingly, but I was very, very calculated. I wouldn't have ever put, even if it was a friend that I thought I could kind of mess with and they could handle themselves. I was trying to kind of, before I even knew what safety briefings were or got into the world of being a first responder and responding to life-saving calls, for some reason that was kind of always in the forefront of my mind. Like, how can I, because I wanted it to be repeatable. So without knowing what my process was or being able to name a protocol or a brief or a debrief, I was kind of just naturally doing that. So it was a long process. You know, one of the things, like in aviation, you never want to go from what your skill level is to up here. You always want to staircase that thing. Because when you do this jump, that's where you've, you know, overreached your abilities and overestimated what you're capable of. And that's where you find yourself in those really dangerous moments. And that approach kind of just was just innately there. And I don't know why. I'm glad it was, but I just took it one step at a time, one day at a time, and wasn't trying to have these giant leaps forward. That's something I'd feel comfortable doing now, but at the time I was trying to mitigate risk. So it was a slow process. I wish there was like a good aha story, but I just took my time with it.
Two of the people that really amazed me, I had Paul De Gelder on the show, the Australian military member who got, I think it was arm and leg bitten off in Sydney Harbor.
In his training, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Bethany Hamilton as well. And both mm-hmm. of them are huge, you know,
advocates,
exactly. So I think that speaks volumes that, yeah, I mean, they thought they were food. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to kill and eat. But for a human being to have such compassion after, you know, having a life-changing event, to still have this love for nature and advocate mm-hmm. for these very creatures. I mean, that's an incredible example of human spirit.
Oh, absolutely. Because that's what I love about it. The perspective shift that takes place when you then you enter their world and you're able to see it, not, you know, not splash around the surface at a beach or on a surfboard, or, you know, you jumped off the boat or whatever. When you enter their world and you see it and you see nature with millions of years of evolution just existing. And sometimes they're curious about you and sometimes they're not. Sometimes they could care less that you're there. It is a huge perspective shift, and you sit there in awe. And yeah, it's no surprise to me. They had devastating injuries, but when I hear stories like that, knowing what I know and what I've experienced and what I've felt, I mean, I've been in the water and shed tears before because nature just is astounding. And you're privileged to see it because, I mean, you could go through a room full of people and you could ask them, have you ever actually seen this? Not on Discovery Channel. Have you actually ever seen this like in the wild? And the numbers are staggeringly low. And when you see it with your own eyes, it's a huge shift in what you appreciate about, you know, the world still being a little bit mysterious and the world still being big and grand and full of surprises. It's a big one.
I was at Crescent Beach just south of St. Augustine, probably 8 months ago now. And it was just mm-hmm. one of those things where it was just me. I like doing the whole, you know, body surfing thing, like a 5-year-old, even though I'm 51 now. And this pod of dolphin just kept swimming by, and it was absolutely beautiful. I'm standing there And it's one of those things where everyone else is on the beach, you know, or they're just they're nowhere near. And I'm just blown away. They're missing this kind of, you know, godlike moment. Cause I truly see, you know, God in nature. I really do. Mm-hmm. But my sister is an editor for the BBC, the National History Department. She was saying, well, you know that dolphin also protect people from sharks, don't you? Mm. And then I was like, oh, so that beautiful moment could have been a great white on the other side of it. Still amazing, but it shifted it for me a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, what about you reflect with all these encounters that you have, you know, are there any that really stand out for any particular reason?
Yes. The moment I talked about earlier where I was shedding tears, I was diving in Tahiti with humpback whales, and they venture from the Northern Pacific, Alaska area, Antarctica, and they come down and they calve in Tahiti in the warm waters. So they eat all winter, then they travel all the way down, mother gives birth, and they spend the next couple of months in Tahiti in the shallow waters just nursing their calves. And I was on a dive, and this gigantic mother comes up from the bottom, comes up to the surface, and then she turns. And I didn't see it the entire time until she turned. But as she turned, the calf is just pinned right to her hip. And the calf, who is this little ball of energy, mom's tired. She's journeyed across the world. She's been feeding milk. She's depleted. She's just hoping like the trip goes well and they get to go home. She's just kind of sombering through. This calf sees us in the water and lights up and thinks we're like the newest toy on the block. So it comes splashing over and twirling and somersaulting. And then as it gets a little bit too far away from mom, mom starts to sing to her and she starts singing back. And I was like, oh man, who's cutting onions? Like just waterworks. I was like, oh, it's the salt water. I was full on just like tearing up. It was like hearing this sing song back and forth between these just like magnificent animals. It was a life changer, man. It was absolutely just a gorgeous moment, highlight reel for the rest of my life. That was the good one. I was diving with tiger sharks in the Bahamas, leading an expedition there. And we were getting some sunset pictures. The tide was switching. The water was getting murky. Tiger sharks are extremely smart. And they know the limits of visibility. They'll use their strike pattern and go just outside of the field of visibility where you can just barely see a shadow glide by. And I knew it was getting to that point where, okay, this is kind of, you know, it could be dinner time. So let's call the dive. Let's get back on the boat. But we'd attracted them with a bait crate. So bait crate was still on the bottom. And I got everybody back in the water. And then it was my job to go swim back solo, grab the crate, get the crate back onto the boat. So the number one rule of tiger sharks is never take your eyes off the tiger shark. I left the boat. I got eyes on the tiger shark. Said, okay. She was coming around, wide pass. And then I was kind of timing out when she would come back around my right-hand side, breathed up, go and do the dive, grab the crate. And I'm trying to do it as quickly as possible. And I did like a glance over my shoulder right before I grabbed the crate. And I thought I had eyes on her. And then as soon as I put my eyes back on the crate to grab it, I realized you didn't check good enough. That wasn't a positive ID. And as soon as I thought that, I thought to myself, this is one of those moments where this was maybe 2 seconds tops, but it like in my brain, it was a lifetime. I thought to myself, she's right behind me. She's 100% right behind me. And as soon as I go to grab the crate and I turn around, the mouth of the tiger shark closed, mind you, she was still swimming calm, is right here, bumps my mask, kind of shifts my mask off. And this school bus just swam right over the top of me. And I just watched her go by, fixed my mask, and just kind of sat there for a second or two, just breathed it in, took that in for what it was worth. That is a self-correcting mistake. We will never do that again. Grabbed the crate. Gave her like kind of a little salute, like, good going, girl. Like, you got me. You're the best at what you do. And then took the crate back to the boat. And the day ended fine. But it was a testament to the intelligence and the vigilance that you have to have. That it's just like in any first responding scenario, in aviation and all the things, you have to reset the clock every single time on what your safety protocols are and what you're letting yourself get away with. It was another one of those aha moments where, all right, every time the rules are the rules, the safety checks are the safety checks. We don't breeze over them. We don't skip them. We do them every time. So I've taken that experience into a lot of avenues in my life, but it was a big life lesson.
It's amazing. That reminds me of when I roll with the black belt in jiu-jitsu. They just kind of kiss me on the head, say, I could have killed you. And then they
got you here. Yeah. Yep. Same scenario.
All right. Well, let's get into the world of aviation then. So you mentioned that you were in school, you were playing, you know, football for as long as you could. Mm-hmm. When did you know that that was the end of your sporting career? And then talk to me about your entry into aviation.
Yeah. So, at the end of my career, at Mississippi State, there was a time, what I wanted to do, my goal was to go fly jets. So I applied to Naval Officer Candidate School and, with my degree. And I knew that there's a time clock, right? So I was come out of college. I had a couple of years where if I wanted to keep chasing like a dream of putting cleats on every day, I could have done that. It was far-fetched. My dad married a very pretty lady that's very petite. He really just kind of hung me out to dry there. So like, I'm self-aware enough to know that, like, you know, he wasn't thinking of me when he married for love.
You should have married a Samoan woman.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd probably still be playing, but I made the decision. I was like, I'm hanging up the cleats and I'm going full force into the next endeavor, which is to fly. And so put in my application, got accepted to Naval OCS under a pilot slot. Went off to OCS in Newport, Rhode Island at the Naval base up there, completed that. And then unfortunately I'd fully disclosed all my medical information as you have to do during flight physicals and everything. I had one injury in high school. It was really my only injury in my entire career. I took a helmet right to the kneecap and I chipped off a piece of my patella, my kneecap. It wasn't, no ligament damage, no nothing. They went in the next day, removed the chip, shaved me down, sewed me up, and I was back on the field pretty quick. But I disclosed it. And then I found out as I was like 2 weeks away from graduating OCS that my medical status, although I'd passed all the preliminary things for flight, was still for some reason pending. And then family came up, graduation day comes. I keep checking this board every day to see, you know, what my status is. And then the day of graduation, about 3 hours before I'm supposed to walk across the stage and then go down to Pensacola for flight training, I get called into my lieutenant's office and he says, your opportunity for flight has been revoked, citing your knee. And I was awestruck. I couldn't even process it because I had already planned out the next 8 years of my life. And once I kind of gather myself, what does that mean? What are we doing? It was like, well, you're going to graduate today, but your opportunity to be an aviator is over. And I left the room and just kind of walked out of there a little awestruck, went over to the hotel where my parents were before the graduation ceremony. I probably got an hour to spare at this point. And I knocked on the door. And as soon as my dad opened the door, I think it finally clicked. And I just broke down and started sobbing and couldn't even get out to him what had happened. And after I did finally explain it, you know, he was like, all right, well, you know, just go figure something out, go figure out the next step. And, you know, just put one foot in front of the other. We'll see you at graduation. You worry about it, you know, when this is over. And walked across the stage and just kind of in this limbo. And then went into flight surgeons the next couple of weeks and trying to get things reviewed and found out at the end that this was 2013. There were huge federal budget cuts. And essentially what they were doing was pouring through a secondary pour through of everybody's medical records. And overnight with budget cuts, we had way more pilots than planes in aviation. It's always this carousel of hire and fire, and we've got more pilots than planes, or now we need pilots. And I caught it on the downswing. And so my naval aviation career was over right then and there. So I had the opportunity to stay in. I could have gone to some different designators and been on a ship and do that. But I'd put 3 years of preparation and flight training and all this into this endeavor. And I was determined to fly. So I got the opportunity just to discharge from the Navy. And that's when I went immediately to the sheriff's office. I wanted to fly in a tactical capacity. That was my goal. I wasn't at the point in my career yet. I didn't want to fly commercially and park the bus at some other terminal and move it back to the home base. And I wanted to have a mission. So sought out the sheriff's office, and uniquely with our sheriff's office and some others across the country, is you've got to work the road no matter what ratings you have. And I came into the agency with pilot ratings, but you still have to go work the road, because our job is to catch people, to render aid and to catch people. So if you don't think like a cop and you don't have, you know, that mindset for catching bad guys, you're really of no use in the helicopter. So work the road in some shady areas for 3 years. And then when an opening came over in the aviation unit, applied and gratefully and thankfully was accepted on the first go around, and have been flying here ever since. So all's well that ended well, but it was, it was an up and down, tumultuous kind of start to the career. And you keep knocking on doors. And if doors don't open, you kick open windows and jump through the window. That's the situation I found myself in.
How did you handle it emotionally at that time when you have this identity and you've already, as you said, told the story in your mind for the next 8 years, mm-hmm. and then your legs are cut from under you? And to be slightly snarky, it's funny because now we seem to have the money to send to Israel, no problem. We can't even yeah. equip our own people, but I'll move right. on with that. So, you know, the identity crisis that we know a lot of people suffer when they leave this profession, mm-hmm. it's the same thing, you know, when you were right there. And I even had it at a much smaller rate when I was young. I was told I was colorblind. I wanted to be a firefighter. Oh. They said, you can't be a firefighter. Now, I'm not colorblind. I'm slightly color deficient, but those books, it's pass or fail, or used to be.
Right.
So, but that was, what was I at the time? 14-year-old boy. So we're not talking about yeah. someone who's invested in all that training at that point. So how did you deal with that initially?
I think the one thing that did help me in that scenario is that hanging up my cleats from football, I was already of the perspective of, I'm not what I do. Like the value in, and the skills that I've learned and the things that I approach life with, that I've learned through all these different, you know, avenues in my life, have prepared me for anything. And I can't remember who, a mentor of mine or a friend or a coach, somebody told me, they're like, you're going to fail a lot in life, but if you can help it, fail quickly. Learn what you can learn. And bring value to the very next thing. And I was devastated, you know, at that time in my life. Like I said, I had it all planned out, you know. And when you make plans, God laughs at you. But I think I had a solid foundation of this kind of cat-like. You will land on your feet. You've got a lot to offer. If you just keep putting your best foot forward, you're not what you do, you are you, and then what you do will fall into place. Just shine through who you are. And thankfully that's the perspective I kept, and knew that it would be a long road. And I just went after it. Like I tried to do with everything else. As soon as I got into the sheriff's department, anybody that I could talk to that knew somebody at aviation or could get me in the hangar door where I could shake hands and say hello and showcase my skill set, you know. And we have a rescue diver program. Like I wanted all the things in my life. I didn't know how they were all going to tie together. The background with wildlife and being in the water since I was little, I wanted that to be a part of my career. I didn't know how that was going to work into aviation. But all of a sudden I walk into a department that has a rescue swimmer program and does overland rescue out in the Everglades, where there's hogs and panthers and alligators and offshore Gulf Coast of Jupiter is the sharkiest spot in the state of Florida. It all just tied together. And once I got to know people and tell them my background, things just kind of gelled, and it was a natural fit, which was a huge relief, just kind of a payoff of that thought process I had that it'll work out. Just keep being you. And that's what I just tried to follow through with.
I love that. I've said this a lot. The mission that takes us into firefighting, for example, isn't to wear a uniform and have a shiny badge and take selfies yeah. with your leather helmet. It's to help people.
yeah.
And so if you were a good person, you wanted to help people before, and you go through a profession, and for whatever reason, the uniform is taken for you one day, The mission has never changed. Just your costume. Yeah. It's like Halloween. Yeah. You know, you don't need a mustache to be a brave person, you know, and then figure out, okay, well, then what is the next thing? How can I help continue this mission to help people make the world better? And in my case, there's nothing that strokes my ego less than being someone who sits in front of a microphone for a profession now. There is no topless podcast or calendar going around that housewives are getting, you know, all crazy about. So from the ego point of view, this is like absolutely zero, but the mission is exactly the same.
The mission is the same.
So that was very kind of, you know, healing for me. It's like, let that go. The kind of image of the, you know, the alpha rescuer, because you did that. Yeah. Been there, done that, bought the t-shirt, loved it. But life kicked me out the door for a different reason and said, right, go help the people in the uniform. And the mission continues.
Oh, fantastic, man. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, but I mean,
better than I could have said it.
I think it's a good thing for people to think about, because it's underlying what you said. I'm just, you know, piggybacking on that, because you said it beautifully, which is, you know, if you have this desire to do this thing, the actual kind of operational elements will come together. But you were always that selfless servant, and you know, don't let the injury, the retirement, the termination, whatever it is, make you think that you're not that anymore. You've always been that before you put the uniform, and you will after.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, then talk to me about what it looks like from someone who's trying to get into law enforcement, aviation, the kind of training on ramp, and then let's kind of unpack all the different areas that you do now.
Yeah. So getting into... The nice thing about like the military is the numbers are big, right? So numbers are big, chances are big. Once you start getting into smaller departments, you really got to, if someone is interested in chasing that down, you got to be flexible. I'm very fortunate, and this was just the stars aligning in some parts of my life. Like in my past military, stars didn't align, but here, literally being in my backyard and having a unit that was this large with this different many mission sets, fit perfectly. But for the most part, departments are small. When people get into this unit, they typically retire in this unit because of the training that's involved, right? I mean, a dedication to learning. I don't know what the hour mark is, but aviation's been compared to a doctorate in some way, as far as, you know, your weather, engineering, you know, whatever it may be, as far as physics and aerodynamics, you learn a lot about a lot, not just a little about a lot. So that is definitely a commitment. So people stay here and they don't move on until they retire. So that your opportunities to get into an aviation unit, especially in smaller law enforcement departments, they are few and far between. So it's something that if you're committed to it, you've got to, it helps to obviously go get ratings on your own. Some agencies will pay for it, some will not. It always, just it like in anything else, anytime you're going in for an interview and you're going to put something on your resume, if you can already say that you've made the effort to start learning this skill and learning this craft, you know, you're above the competition for the most part. Anybody that's a go-getter, you know, you're going to go try and do as much homework as you can prior to taking the test. And that's something I did coming into the unit with ratings, and then switching over to the helicopter side. Our unit and agency pushed that training through. And that was a couple year process for me to get schooled up on helicopters, which now I can't live without them. Thought I was always an airplane guy. And then you make the switch and you're like, oh man, life's better going backwards. But yeah, it was moving on from that, you know, getting the opportunity. And then kind of talking about what we do as a unit here. We have a very, very unique and diverse mission set, because Palm Beach County is huge, and we've got the Everglades on one side, we've got the Gulf Stream coast on the other. And as far as our support offshore, there's a Coast Guard station in Jacksonville, and there's a Coast Guard station in Miami that has air division capabilities. But both of those assets are an hour to an hour and a half away. So we take on, with the inlets that we have here and the seas that we have here and the water out west in the Everglades, lakes and ponds and rivers and canals, we're equipped with the devices and training to answer those calls before it even needs to get to that, you know, to that federal government level. you know, Department of Defense. So we chase bad guys all day. Offshore rescue, inshore rescue, all the work that we do with specialty units, SWAT, whether that's insertion into hot zone areas, high altitude surveillance. And then we also, you know, we have a big commitment to a VIP that lives in the area. The president lives right down the street. We're also involved in his safety and security of the motorcade as well. So we have dignitary responsibilities here. It's a extremely unique unit. This really the only thing we don't do is fight fires. But we do a lot. And to exist here in this unit, you kind of have to be a Swiss Army knife. And then take on the responsibility of being good at all of it, because this is a dangerous business, and aviation is wonderful, but is very unforgiving. So it's something that you have to dedicate the time and craft to if you want to have a long career. So,
speaking of it being dangerous, we've obviously had numerous tragedies in helicopters. I was just actually speaking to one of the DC chiefs who's coming on the show, and he's going to talk about that tragedy as well, and the response to that tragedy, more to the point. But I've had several other, you know, helicopter pilots on the show. And one of my friends, Dave, flew with Prince William. Get that right? Yes, okay. Prince William. Back in the day. And they had some crazy near misses and whiteouts and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Talk to me overall. Like, are we... Is this profession being... broken down by budget cuts, and is that making it more dangerous for some of these agencies? Is it just happened that a few of them happened in a cluster? What are you seeing with this obviously far more educated lens that I have as far as some of these recent tragedies we had in law enforcement, EMS, and the military?
Yeah, well, I think the Achilles heel of any, you know, first responder profession is to do more with less. That's kind of, you know, you have people that we naturally take on that responsibility, but culturally, that's always kind of the, hey, you know, this is the budget, do more with less. And that's just a byproduct of the industry. And it's something that I think we could get away with 10, 15 years ago. But with the demand for flight time, the demand for the support, especially in areas like this that are growing year after year after year, and call volume is going up year after year after year, we always lag behind what the actual operational necessity is. We try and get by with, you know, that, you know, whatever makes the budget work as is. And that's also, you know, that's certainly a professional consideration that we need to, if we're serious about not only taking care of the public, but taking care of the people that put the shield on or put the badge on, that's something that we probably do need to have a more realistic conversation about. We're flying days, we're flying nights, we're swapping back and forth between schedules. And there's nothing scarier than lifting off the ground at 4 a.m. and you're hovering in a helicopter, and that's when you wake up, you know, that's when you come to that. Oh, I'm flying, you know, a multi-million-dollar aircraft, and you get what I'm trying to say. It's a conversation that certainly, I mean, there's more planes, there's more helicopters in the sky than ever before. And every single day that we would sit down and have this interview, I'd be saying that again, and it would be true. The number will just continue to grow. But the policies and the regulations will always lag behind. But the growth is just exploding in some areas, and we're not keeping up.
As you sit there now, Palm Beach County is in the transition to the 24/72 firefighter work week, which is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I hope that one of the residents, Donald, will go, oh, well, if my firefighters have this, maybe the whole country should have it. So if he hears this, I'm just sowing that seed now, if we're going to really proactively help the first responder professions.
Manifest it.
But that being said, you know, there really aren't any checks and balances when it comes to sleep in fire and EMS, especially. Mm-hmm. What are the stipulations, the barriers when it comes to the aviation side?
We have kind of our set of rules within our department that limits flight time. We are very lucky here. We have a phenomenal command staff that if we're burned out, because a lot of people don't realize, I mean, flying dynamically, it's one thing to pick up, go from point A to point B and set down, but dynamically at night over zero light conditions over the ocean or the Everglades, where you literally can't tell the horizon line from the ground. You're inside the helicopter, you're out, you know, you're looking inside instrumentation, you're outside, you're on NVGs, this constant scan, you're looking over your shoulder, kind of peeking to make sure that your camera angle and the way you've oriented the aircraft is on par with what your camera operator needs to keep eyes on a suspect to make a call work, or else it's all a wasted effort. Not to mention you've got micro vibrations for an hour and a half, 2 hours that are just as you're sitting there, tiny, but an hour and a half of this just, you know, shuddering the entire time will wear you out. Our command staff is phenomenal. If we are burnt, we can pick up a phone at any time of night, any time in the morning and say, hey, you got to bring somebody in. Now, like I was saying about earlier, culturally, would we ever do that? I'd like to say we would, but we won't. You know, it's just chug a Red Bull and hard press on. That's the reality of it. But we do have limitations, 5 hours flight time at night. Anything starts to scratch close to that, we need to make phone calls, and make sure that a fresh crew comes in so that we're keeping ourselves safe. But more importantly, we're not flying over the middle of nowhere half the time. We're over high populated areas. So the public safety is a part of our diagnosis and briefing as to whether or not we should be flying or not. So that's always a main point.
Is there a national industry standard as well?
No. The airline guys and their unions have stuff pretty dialed in. They got it going pretty good. But as far as law enforcement in general or any type of mission set specific to us, it all just comes down to individual agencies and what they adopt. But for the most part, they do listen to their pilots, you know. So it's not necessarily an uphill battle. It's a culture battle of, will you get a pilot to say that he needs help? Maybe you do, maybe you don't.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned the rescue swimmer side as well. And I always said, this would entail me actually passing the selection, but if I was going to enter a branch of the special forces, special operations, the PJs would be the one. I think that's the one that closely replicates the fire service. And I've always, you know, loved water myself. I was a lifeguard for a long time. Doesn't mean I would have passed, but that was what I would have tried to pass.
You would have passed.
but that being said, you know, it's such an admirable profession, especially some of the conditions that some of these men and women are in, you know, affecting these rescues. So talk to me about that side, because not only have you got, you know, the aquatic nature, as we mentioned before, you've got apex predators within that aquatic nature. So it's quite a danger upon danger element to facilitate some of these rescues.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, one of the biggest things that I've seen as somebody that runs our rescue swimmer program, the physical attributes have to be there. Obviously we do a swim test very, very similar to the Coast Guard's, that absolutely smokes you, something that you have to stay current on. But there is something to be said about just being comfortable in the water, because it is a very, very lonely business when you leave that safety blanket of the aircraft and it's you and what you're wearing, and those are the tools that you have. Those are the tools that you have to deal with whatever's going on in the water. Those are the tools that you have to deal with the victim, and get yourself back into the aircraft, which there's always a possibility that if you get out, maybe the seas keep pitching and roll, maybe you don't get back in. So I think one of the biggest things that I look for and the biggest blessings for me is just, there's not much water that you can put me in. Now, we're very lucky. I'm not in the Bering Sea. I'm not in Alaska. I'm in warm tropical waters, but I'm comfortable in it all. I'm comfortable in black water. We've had calls in the Everglades where it's a foot and a half of visibility. And the last question somebody asks you before you get out of the aircraft is, there's three alligators. Are you comfortable? You know, and for some, it's not the same answer for everybody. I've just been fortunate enough to have that experience. And I feel like I've got it under control. So that's one of the biggest things, is I think that element of somebody just being comfortable, completely alone, completely by yourselves, where the only backup that you have are people that can just watch you and just make sure that you pop back up or that you safety signal, and that's all they can really do for you. So that's a huge part of just being successful, I think, is being able to keep your body, your heart rate, your mind from just racing in these scenarios where you're very much alone.
You mentioned having to stay current on swimming. How many years?
Oh, as far as like what the, like what our
recertifying.
Oh yeah. It's every year. And we train, I mean, we train twice a month. Rescue swimmers get together and we go through our paces. But the yearly, and those, if you can make it through our you know, get together swims, you'll be fine for the test. But yeah, yearly we go back through and everybody's got a requal.
So, cause I've said this recently, one of my lifeguard friends, a while ago now, kind of just reminded me that we have these annual tests or every 2 years in some organizations, but as a lifeguard, if you can't pass a test after a year, 2 years, you're not a lifeguard anymore. Mm-hmm. With this, you know, this bar that you're held to, even though, you know, you're on the pilot side as well, what is your perspective of law enforcement and fire resisting any fitness standards whatsoever?
Ooh, man, that's a hard one. It's an interesting question because Drew, who was our introduction and a phenomenal Army pilot and now flies reserves for the Air Force. I've had this conversation with him a ton of times. You know, we've talked about the challenges of doing this in the EMS and law enforcement world, where not only are you held to a very high standard, but you go back to life every single day. You're not on a deployment where it's mission, 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 tune up for the mission, complete the mission, and then you get to come home. And it's just different challenges. It's very hard. Speaking honestly, to find guys and women that can keep it all together, keep the family life, keep their physical fitness, keep their mental fitness all in shape. And it presents some serious challenges. And I think that the resistance that you're talking about comes to just a simple level of fatigue that comes from trying to keep all level, you know, six plates in your life that are all at, you know, danger's edge or have huge implications on your life and the quality of life spinning at the same time and spinning at the same speed. So it's, and I know that, and then you're going to have your, you know, your feet draggers that just, they're going to complain because they're going to complain. But what we face in our side of things, because we do get go-getters, is that even with go-getters, it's just hard. It's just a different nature of the beast where you've got to do a lot and you've got to be good at a lot and you've got to keep your standards where your standards are going to be. And, you know, and life changes, you know, what worked for a guy before he was married or when he was in a relationship or now he's got kids. Hey, no harm, no foul. Give me your vest, you know, figure it out. Job's still here if you want it. And if you can resubmit that same level of commitment, then it's here, but we're going to keep the standard, what the standard is. And if that means you've got to come and go and come and go, then we'll figure it out because we need the bodies, but you know, we're not going to drop our standard. You know, it's just, we can't do that to the public.
Yeah. And this is how I feel about police and obviously fire, especially that's my profession, fire and EMS. Mm-hmm. But you're right. This is where I'm always trying to be very, universal in the way I look at this. Ownership is part of it, of course, but what, mm-hmm. what is ownership from? It's your entire life up to that point. You grew up working on farms. I grew up on a farm. So there's a mm-hmm. different level of understanding of work ethic and movement and, you know, the importance of nature and understanding where food actually comes from that all factor into these good decisions later. But absolutely, I could not agree more, which is why I fight so hard for the work week in the fire service. At the moment, when you've got people working 56, 80 plus hour weeks, how can you then ask them to maintain a standard? They should maintain a standard, but you haven't given them an environment to maintain a standard.
And with what left in the tank are they supposed to maintain the standard?
Exactly. Yeah. So this is what's exciting now. Alongside, hey, we're giving you a 42 hour work week, there mm-hmm. should now start to be in these departments that are going that way, the conversation about, right, now we need to put in a fitness standard. Now that we've actually created an environment that does forge performance and longevity, and we've put you back in your family where you're supposed to be, which is so important, which then heals that element. Now your sleep is better. Now your testosterone is better. Now your body composition is better. Now let's hold you back to where you were in the fire academy.
Yes.
Because I don't understand people saying it's not fair with the standard itself. It's like, that's literally what you were told you had to do to become a firefighter. Yeah. So don't come at me with that bullshit. Same with the police, you know, but so when we fix the environment, this is the thing. It's a win-win, because then you bring in a fitness standard. Now the performance is at a high level, and the longevity of the first responder now, you know, becomes so much greater. And so no one can say there's any downside. There isn't a downside, but we have to find our way back there. But so, like you said, to demand it without changing the work week is not going to work. And to change the work week without demanding a fitness standard is not going to work. So
it's
both of those together.
Two punch combo. It's got to be one. Yeah, they got to be both at the same time. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you touched on the SWOT side too. So what are some of the notable calls where the skill set that you and your crew had facilitated an arrest or stopping something horrible happening to someone?
I'll tell you one off the top of my head. They had a suspect that was fleeing, and in any cityscape, you start to run into those streets and names and lanes where it's first street, first avenue, first place, and nobody know. There's no, you couldn't figure out with an atlas and a GPS iPhone where you are, and when you're running after somebody, you know, a violent suspect. It convolutes the question even more. That day I was flying with one of our most skilled pilots in the unit. I was actually operating the camera, and one of our guys who was in pursuit of the suspect got by himself, and nobody for the life of him or for the life of anybody else could find where he was, where the chase was going down, what direction they were heading. He was just, the blinders were on and the streets didn't make sense. And we were the only people that had eyes on him. And we were trying to give people directions. We'll turn left at 3rd Avenue, and then you're going to run into 3rd Lane. And it wasn't happening. So the skilled pilot that I was with, absolutely phenomenal. There was a canal bank. I mean, just about as wide to fit a helicopter in. And he said, "Can you help him?" I looked out and I said, looked over at him. I said, "Yeah." And before I even finished, we were descending out of the air. The aircraft was placed in the ground perfectly in a tight, confined area. I hopped out, gun, radio. I knew exactly where they were running. We headed them off. We made the apprehension together. And before I was, even feet on the ground, the helicopter was back in the air. He was flying, keeping eyes on us, still calling out to other units while talking to other air traffic. I mean, the guy was a rock star doing it all. And we were able to make an apprehension. we draw down on the guy, and I've got a helmet on. I'm in a flight suit. I've got my firearm, and I come around the corner, make eye contact with my fellow deputy. We sprawl the suspect out on the ground, and he just keeps looking at me like, what are you doing here? And I said, we'll talk about it in a second. And literally, I'll never forget this. We're pointed out the suspect, and he looks at me, he goes, "This is the coolest day I've ever had at work in my life." Like, we're mid arrest, and he had to get that out. and we made the apprehension. I gave him a knuckle up, and the call ended well. Everybody was safe. Nobody got hurt. Got back in the helicopter, flew back, and we landed, refueled, did our paperwork. And about a half hour later, the deputy called me and said, "Hey man, I can't thank you enough what you guys did. I was completely alone. It's incredible to know that in those oh crap moments, you guys are there." And gave me chills, man. It was one of those days where just like, job well done. And everybody went home safe. He went home to his family, and that's what it's all about. And mission accomplished.
I've been having conversations with strength and conditioning coaches that work with the military, normally, you know, the upper tiers of the military, and then some of them also work with us. And it was crazy going back. It's really going back to the fitness standards when it comes to them working with the SEALs, Delta, you know, again, Pararescue, whoever it is they're working with, they're helping them squeeze out performance. Now they come work for police and fire. Let's just say fire because that's the arena I know. And they're like, well, we need to get you walking more. Here's how to make a bowl of oatmeal. You know, let's basically try and get you to die a little bit less than you are at the moment.
Yeah.
And now, again, going back to this movement in Florida, especially where this wellness lens has changed the work week, and now we're talking about fitness standards, there's a chasm between where we are and where we could be as far as performance. And I think that story is a beautiful example. If you did the bare minimum in all these roles, would you have had the skill set to land the bird where you did, to apprehend the fitness, you know, the tactical know-how, I mean, all the things. So these are, you know, the areas that I think we just don't have these conversations, you know, that the ability to critically think, the ability to use your physicality and your, you know, your intelligence and wit to mitigate some of these situations. That's what you get from that next level of training, fitness, and, you know, rest and recovery.
Absolutely. And I think one of the worst things that you can do in those situations is have the mindset that you're still whatever level of fitness, your actual fitness be lacking. And then when you hop out of the helicopter or you hop out of the fire truck and you start to sprint in that direction, now all we've got is another victim, you know, and that is the worst thing that you can do for yourself, for the team that you're working with. My goal has always just been useful and to keep the spear sharp so that there wasn't a moment where, oh, hey, get Chris some water. I'll get water when this is done, you know, so that we can accomplish what the mission and the goal is. And absolutely, because that in between where you are trying to help or you're fighting for your life, and then you have that voice in your head click, say, I'm not ready for this. In law enforcement, that's when dangerous mistakes happen. That's when people go to their weapon that they shouldn't have been going to their weapon for. They try and do something because they are gassed. They are at their absolute limitation, and that didn't have to be the case, you know. And it's not. I'm not here standing up on a soapbox saying everybody's got to be Captain America, but there is a huge gap. There is a chasm that we need to fill because it makes you safer. It gets you home to your family, and it keeps the public safe. And that's the goal of all of this, and the physical fitness component of that fits into a very large piece of that pie, for sure.
Absolutely. Well, just while we're on the, you know, the law enforcement side, as far as, you know, SWAT and all these other things, when I'm thinking of pilots in the military setting, and I don't know if I'm just thinking of video games and this is absolute bullshit, but I'm thinking that the friendly soldiers have the beacons, so the pilots know who, you know, who they're after and who they're not. Is there an element of that in law enforcement? Because I can imagine when there's all these white, you know, outlines and they're trying to figure out who is who.
We do use some of that tech and some of those advantages with tracking with our canine, just because the pace that they're moving. And usually if they're searching, it's in and out of tree lines, in and out of bush lines, through, you know, through brush or through houses where they're going to turn corners and they're going to pop back out. So we have those capabilities. We've got capabilities to identify things to them on the ground that they can be privy to. So we can identify targets that nobody else can see, but our guys can see it and kind of see where we're looking and where we're pointing to. So we have those I think people would be surprised to know of our capabilities, but that's our secret to keep as well.
Yeah. Well, what about on the canine side? You see some pretty amazing things as far as insertion with dogs. Talk to me about that, if anything, on the canine side and what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, for what our capabilities are, and we have forward looking infrared and we have that ability to see heat signatures and things like that. But there's plenty of times where canopy cover, you know, and whether it's a metal roof or a shed or something like that, where we can't get a strong enough heat signature, and with the camera work, you would breeze right over it thinking spot's clear, only to have the dog, you know, a couple seconds behind your trail. And then all of a sudden you hear this keying up on the radio and somebody screaming in the background because we found him.
Right.
So, no, yeah, there's never a lack of element of surprise as to what those dogs can do and their capability with incredible handlers, that do an awesome job. Those guys are relentlessly training. They take their craft very, very seriously. And they keep those dogs just in phenomenal shape, and just their ability to communicate with them and identify, you know, victim, suspect, targets, you know, just standby, you know, person that's just calling in the call, how they can weave those dogs through a crowd and stay on a trail. It's impressive.
Absolutely.
Makes the job fun. Just because sometimes you get kind of lured into just watching it. You feel like you're watching an episode of Cops and you're actually working it.
What about, before we go to, I want to go to the mental health next, but what about as far as your own ability to stay in good physical condition, not so much the fitness standards, but as far as the wear and tear? The reason I ask that, my friend Dave is a pilot and he's had a lot of issues with the neck because you got the helmet, you got the nods and just that weight. And like you said, the G's and everything else as well. And then I've had another person that was even implying that, what about the flight suits, the same PFAS issues that we're looking at in our gear as firefighters, you know, that there's an element of that in aviation as well. So all things health in a pilot's position, talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the PFAS thing, if I could write a memo and just let me fly in board shorts and a shirt and flip-flops, and hey, if I'm going to burn up, I'm going to burn up, man. Just let me burn up quick. I don't want to live through life, you know, the rest of the time. But yeah, that it's in the back of my mind, you know, the exhaust, the turbine engines, all that, it's in the back of my mind. There's not much I can do about it. And I, you know, I'll probably change my mind when I'm older, but right now it's like, it's the life I chose and it's what lights my world on fire. So I'll deal with it. But the physical side is probably the thing I feel the most. The neck issues, there's well-documented cases of all the hours of the military guys. They've done a better job of documenting it than law enforcement has, but MVGs, weighted helmets. And then, you know, for the most part, we do pull G's in the aircraft. We're not, you know, doing aerobatic flight, but you come into a tight turn and you're pulling another half pound of G's or another half G or a full G. And now your 8 pound helmet where it weighs 16 pounds. And it's, you know, for a half hour, 45 minutes of 16 pound strain pulling your neck down. I feel that every single time I work a night shift. And it's one of those things where body in motion stays in state. Oh my gosh, I'll say that again. Body in motion stays in motion. So if I'm not working out and I'm not doing, you know, weight training, I fall apart. I mean, the back helicopter seats, it's like flying Spirit Airlines. It's terrible. You're crammed into a tiny little seat the whole time. So the physicality of it is definitely something that I personally address. And that's, I just do not miss a day in the gym or else it gets worse. You know, you think you want to take a day off, especially after night shift. You think you do. You think that's like the, just kind of like, well, I'll just rest or I'll just recover. And then the next morning you wake up and you're paying the price for it. So it's a constant vigilance thing. Just staying sharp. Trying to beat off Father Time.
That sounded weird when you said it that way. I had the creator of, I think it's the Iron Neck. I hope I got that name right. But
yeah, I've used it. We have one at the hangar here.
How do you find that helping with this issue?
It actually helps a lot, and they're not paying me to say that. Just an honest assessment. No, if my neck is stiff, I'll do the full kind of, they've got that little card that, you know, shows you all the exercises. I'll run through that and it loosens the neck back up, like gets me right back in the game. I was actually very impressed with it. Yeah, I got it. And I was thinking like, well, here's another thing from Joe Rogan we're going to give a shot, you know, shout out to. And it worked. It's fantastic.
Very cool. All right. Well, then shifting to the mental health side, obviously we kind of touched on it when we were talking about your grandparents, but
yeah,
as you've progressed through, obviously, the military more on an educational side and then, you know, actually being boots on the ground, boots above the ground, in your case, in the law enforcement side, what were some of the highs and lows of your own journey? And then let's start talking about, you know, your lens on that whole issue now.
Mm-hmm. I think the hardest calls are definitely and the hardest experiences for me, I think for anybody that's just trying to help, is the ones where you can't help. where you were just, and it's beyond your control, you were too late or whatever the case may be. Those just sting because there's a lot of just what ifs. And you can really find yourself beating yourself up about that. Well, what if we'd have gotten out and gotten the aircraft? What if, you know, we had taken off faster or the airport would have cleared us to get there? And you could just chase your tail all day, you know, trying to figure that out. Those sting. We do get called. It's South Florida, Florida for that matter. You know, there's bodies of water everywhere and there's kids everywhere. Those are heartbreaking. I'm not a father yet. I have a niece and nephew that I would take a bullet for. And those are tough days. Those are days I just go home and I just like take my dog, sit her on the couch and just kind of just go silent for a little bit. Cause that one just is a complete gut punch, but dealing with it, I'm very fortunate. My girlfriend, her father was former NYPD. She's someone that gets it. And we're on the same page as to the fact that we're not doing it how the previous generation did. We're taking all the good things that we saw and we're bringing that forward into our relationship, but the communication is wide open and tough days get talked about. And if tough days don't get talked about, she gives me the grace and the time to process it. And then it gets talked about. And we have that ability, and I have that ability to have an outlet and somebody that is able to just understand a little bit deeper into kind of the lens that I'm looking through the world with. So that's been huge. And then we have a phenomenal unit here too, where part of our debrief is you're going through your checks, you come back from a call, this is what went good, this is what we could have done better. That all gets sorted. And then the last question is, hey, is everybody okay? And who's feeling it? Who's not? And I've had those conversations with guys who have had kids. And we've been on those calls where, whether it's a pool or a canal or whatever case we might find them in, where we come back, we take a little somber moment, we talk about it. Hey, man, I just can't, you know, I'm thinking about my kids now and that kind of thing. And it gets talked about. Doesn't get stuffed down. The conversations are had. And we have a great agency too, where if it needs to go to another level, a more professional level, if kind of, you know, the guys can't handle it, then meaning that we can't handle it internally, just speaking together, that we've got the resources and it's encouraged. Our agency does a great job of pushing that the help is there if you need it. And they encourage us to get it, you know. And it's not a thing from the past where now you got egg on your face and you're a guy that called the hotline, and that kind of culture is slowly dying out, and it's certainly for the best.
One of the things that I've kind of observed myself, because that inability to save is crushing, and I've said this many times on the podcast, when I responded to a cardiac arrest, they are already, mm-hmm. the heart is not beating. In 14 mm-hmm. years plus, I actually worked a code on a plane about a year ago in London. I have zero saves, not a single one. And so if you look at the way that we're trained, well, you go through school, you learn the drugs, you learn your cardiac, you know, algorithms. And, you know, if I give this drug and these CPR and then this defibrillation, then the person wakes up and they come to the station, they bring a cake, we take a photo, it's in the paper. 14 years later, you're like, fucking hell, am I the Grim Reaper? What is wrong with me?
Right.
But I think the thing that appeases that is, again, going back to what we talked about with standards and training and fitness and everything. If you know that you've done everything you could to prepare, then I think that's where you can lean into and go, you know, I'm not God. I'm not going to, you know, we were never going to save everyone, but we did everything that we could. It was, you know, somewhat in the way it was supposed to. We all know it's organized chaos. So it's never like clinical when we go through these codes. But I think we're a very dangerous place that some people inhabit is these agencies that are lax, that don't have the fitness standards, don't have the training standards. And that person knows in their heart of hearts that maybe that person died because of their skill set or lack thereof.
Yeah, that's very, very heavy. And I know that goes on. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a dangerous place to be, because there's not much you can't do anything about it after the fact. And that's a heavy thing to carry, for sure.
Well, you mentioned as well in the debrief about what can we do better. I think that's a really important thing. You know, we call it tailbore critique in the fire service, and the good crews that I work with, we would always do that at the end, you know, kind of assess what went well, what could we do better next time? Because you might not have saved that person, but was there a way of getting off, you know, getting in the air 60 seconds earlier the next time? Was there an area that can be improved on? So talk to me about that, because other places I've worked, there wasn't. It was just like, well, no one died, so we're good. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Which is a horrible way of doing it.
Yeah. Culturally, I think if you really do want to have an elite unit, that has to be internal. Because the fact of the matter is that first responders are given some grace. There's nobody really looking over your shoulder saying, nobody's doing an audit on your life-saving attempt. That all has to come internally. The public just trusts that you are trying to do your best, which is a huge responsibility. And I think it's an absolute disservice if you're letting that and you're just kind of riding that out. We, in our debriefs, we have our conversations. We talk about the call, and maybe there's some high-fiving that goes on, but there is a specific moment where it's, all right, this point of the debrief, it's time for thick skin. And we have very honest conversations. And the mention of thick skin is to get everybody in the right headspace that, hey, this is a reminder. Nobody's coming after anybody, but our standard is very high and nobody here is perfect. We are all of the same mind that we want to put out the best product possible. So with that in mind, we're going to get into the nitty gritty and we're all going to hold ourselves accountable for the standard that we've set. And I think that's absolutely essential because, like I said, nobody else is doing that for you. That's not in a manual. That's not coming down from your higher ups. That's just policed internally at the unit level. And that culture either exists or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then you're going to be left to wonder how good you could have been, really could have been at your job, or how much, more good you could have helped, how much more good you could have done. And that's not a question I want to be asking myself in my, twilight years, sitting back on my porch. I want to leave it all out there and have that comfort of knowing that, we're not going to save them all. In fact, to your point, we're not going to save a lot of them. But we're going to give it everything we got, and we're going to try and be the best that we can at our profession and our job for sure.
Absolutely. And again, it goes back to this conversation on all these areas. It's like, it's not one side, it's both sides. You know, you've got to have the ownership as a first responder to hold yourself to a high bar. And there's got to be an environment to allow you to get to that high bar, to function at that high level. So it's, and but you see a lot of finger pointing in agencies. Well, if, admin just did this, if the firefighters just did that, it's like, well, how about you both did what you're supposed to do?
Yeah.
Then, rising tide will lift all ships. Everyone will benefit then.
Yeah. Yeah. We're in a unique position too, because once that helicopter lifts off, it's only us. It's who's in that aircraft. And, just like probably responding in any rescue vehicle or fire engine, the higher ups and all that, we leave them behind when we go fly away and we go fly to a scene, which is nice in a sense. You definitely want their support and everything, but it's about looking across the cabin and looking at the people you're with and knowing, hey, this is, this feels good. Cause for what we've trained and what we've done, I feel like I'm with the A team, and that's a good feeling to have. And it makes a huge difference on the decisions you make and the outcome of cases and calls. When you look around the room and you're like, okay, that guy's tip of the spear, that guy's tip of the spear, that guy's greatest job. Like, you just, there's a confidence and a synergy that comes from that, that just improves the product all the way across the board. But it starts at the base level. It's got to be something everybody's all in on.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to shift to some closing questions, but I want to be mindful of your time as well. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
Yeah. Deepak Chopra, Metahuman. It's like one of my favorite books. It's great. It is, I wouldn't even know actually where to start. It's like, it's the perspective I try and take into work every single day and with life, that life is not your circumstances. It's almost like we're just, actors in a play, man, what is happening is already happening. Just do the best that you can, be there for the experience and maximize it. It's, I read that book actually right before I went and climbed, Aconcagua, which is one of the seven summits. And I don't think I would have made it to the top without it.
I heard, do you know who Wayne Dyer is?
I know that name.
He did a lot of stuff with Deepak when he was alive, but he died of leukemia a few years ago. But he, I guess best to describe him as like a white Deepak Chopra. He just took all the wisdom from everything, like the holy texts, you know, ancient wisdom, all the things, and boiled it down to just common sense, which is why I love it, because I don't subscribe to any specific religion. I just think that there's common denominator wisdom in everything. That's why it's being passed down. But I think it was in a conversation with Wayne, I'm not sure, but Deepak was talking about going to India, and there was some holy place where it was written on pieces of bark, and your name was on there, and it said that, you know, the date that you were going to die. And again, it was almost like that stoicism, you know, they kind of find like, oh wow, everything is already written out for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, some people would say, well, it's just a crazy Indian guy writing dates on a piece of wood, and other people are all in. But regardless, it's that same mindset, like you said, is like, whether you like it or not, you know, the sun's going to rise, the sun's going to fall. So, you know, are you going to resist it the whole way, or are you going to put something, you know, worth doing in your heart and just trust the process?
That's it. Love that.
Absolutely. All right. What about films and documentaries?
Ooh, films and documentaries. I get, it's probably low hanging fruit, but man, any like Animal Planet series, like Planet Earth, can't get enough of those. I could fall asleep to those like 24/7, 365 at the end of a day. Specific films. It would also be cliche of me to say everybody should see Top Gun, but I'm not going to go that route either. That's a tough one. Specific films. Oh, Memphis Belle was absolute. That was like one of those catalyst movies when I was younger, and I think it had a lot to do with my grandparents and the stories that I heard and grew up hearing and talking about. Bomber crew in World War II makes it to 25 missions, first bomber crew to ever do it, so they got to go home. The pressure that those guys were under at that young age to do those bombing raids in daylight, absolutely unimaginable, to be honest, but one of my favorite movies.
Did you ever watch Masters of the Air?
Yes, I did.
What do you think of that one? I had Dale Dye on the show, and it was pretty amazing hearing the kind of backstory. But what was your perception as a pilot?
No, same perspective as with Memphis Belle. There's guys in those aircraft that don't even have facial hair yet, and that is, I think what that movie really encapsulated really well that maybe other movies in the past haven't is the chaos of when those planes were under attack during those runs, and literally just planes falling out of the sky left and right. And they go home to land, and half of their friends did not come back. Like the sheer numbers of loss is something I don't think we've seen in a very long time. It's very, very, very unique to that time period where we were just, it was all about manpower and no smart bombs. It was just how many people can you put into an aircraft? How many aircraft can you put in the air? And numbers win the war. And it was just very, very different landscape and devastating what those guys saw.
I think the other thing as well is when you watch Band of Brothers and the Pacific and Master of the Air, and you realize, wow, this is obvious what I'm about to say, but there was no GPS. So you're literally on a boat, then on a beach, and then there's a bunch of bunkers up there, and you've got you got a map, or you're in a plane and you've got your altimeter and everything. But
you're looking at some kid that you hope paid attention in navigation school and hoping he hadn't nodded off in the back.
I mean, that just adds another level that blows my mind, you know. There's no, like you said, you know, heat signature of the Germans from Overwatch. Like they could literally be behind the wall that you're walking forward and then that's it. You're done.
Yep. Different time when men were men, right?
Absolutely. And it goes back to the beginning of the conversation, you know?
Yeah.
The toll that that must have taken, that constant fear, even the Vietnam generation going through those jungles, you know, and the Korean veterans that are forgotten constantly. I've got one coming on the show, actually, but that's an era that, I mean, if you see what they did, the North Koreans pushed the South Koreans all the way to literally the southwestern tip of the country, and the Allies pushed them all the way back to the halfway point again. It was amazing what those men and women did.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then the next question, is there a person that you recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military and associated professions of the world?
Oh,
and it can be anyone.
Yeah. John Rourke, who's also in this area, was a former member of the military army. He a complete service life. He started the company Blue Line Moving a couple of years ago, actually, when people were exodusing from New York and coming down to Florida. He was doing an incredible job of offering opportunities for first responders to come down and come populate the Sunshine State. But an absolute incredible example of service. He's been down to Eagle Pass and the southern border a ton. He did cleanups down there. He's done that the past couple of years under the Great American Cleanup. And just a really good guy. I would definitely recommend him to the podcast. Just a service-oriented patriot, for sure.
Beautiful. That's just spurred a question I meant to ask you earlier. A lot of people in the usually the EMS helicopter side, we're talking when I was earlier in my career, there was still a lot of Vietnam era pilots, and you hear these like horror stories of these medics hanging on for dear life in the back.
Yeah.
Was there any interaction as you progressed into that side with some of these incredible pilots from that era?
Well, I think I kind of like hit it in the middle as those guys were. Like I caught stories, but never really any like actual full on interactions or flying with those guys, which is unfortunate. Shared coffee with them a couple of times, that kind of thing. But yeah, most of the guys that I've met had kind of hung it up and were just happy in retirement. Happy not being in an aircraft that shook the entire time anymore.
Yeah. Whilst being shot at.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then the last question before we make sure where people can find you and the services that you offer as well. What do you do to decompress?
Ooh, I get out in nature. That's it, man. I take my shoes off. I take my shirt off and I go walk around in nature. So where people can find me. The goal is that nobody can find me, but that's it. Cause that's always been the great reset for me, is that this is a hustle and bustle job in a hustle and bustle community. And I look forward to just quiet moments. It's one of the things about like the apex predator interactions. You can't be anywhere else but where you are in those moments. That's the beauty of it. Like you're not worried about bills. You're not worried about getting dumped. You're not worried about this missing this person's birthday. You are completely in the moment because the nature of the animal that you're interacting with deserves that respect. And as intense as it is, it's incredibly peaceful for that very reason. So that's where you'd find me.
There are myths about what you should do if you face a shark, like one big one you hear. I don't know if it's a myth even, but they say, well, punch it in the nose. Well, punching people in the nose. It's actually harder than you think. I don't know about a shark. Yeah. But what are some of the humorous myths that you heard about sharks and gators? And then what are some of the things that are truths as far as people increasing their survivability, God forbid they are faced by surprise?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the worst one I've ever heard is, you know, swim away as fast as you can. That's, you might as well be ringing the dinner bell. But I've heard the nose punches, the eye gouges, all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, the beauty of all these wild animals is that they're very honest, right? They like, it's way easier than people. They're not trying to trick you. They're not trying to pull one over on you. But the biggest deterrent for any natural predator, especially in the water. Can't speak to really like the giant stuff like bears and that kind of thing, but eye contact is your cage. Eye contact is the number one solve. They're all ambush predators. So if you can solidify eye contact and let them know that you're aware of them 100% fully and that you're on their radar the entire time they're looking at you, they will keep a distance. Wildlife and life in nature is too rough and tumble to get into some fight. If they get hurt, they die. So if they can't sneak up, it's a far cry for them to actually want to put in the effort, burn the calories to actually try and tussle with you. So just keep your eyes on the prize. That'll usually serve you through.
So humans are the only ones that get their chest all puffed out when you make eye contact with the wrong person.
Yeah.
Is there a problem, man?
Some little league t-ball game or at a bar. Yeah,
exactly. All right. Well, speaking of that, then, if people first want to learn about the guiding and those kind of things that you do in that area, where are the best places to go for that?
Oh, man, just come to social media, just my Instagram. I'm an open book. They can DM me. They can send me a message, drop a comment. Always open to talk and interact with people that either want to learn more or come join us out for a dive or do something. So I'm easy to find.
What's your handle on social media?
What is it? Cameron C? Hold on. You're going to have to edit this part.
That's
right.
I don't
even remember. Yeah. It's Chris Cameron, my name, .cc. ChrisCameron.cc.
Perfect.
That's it.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation. Thank you to Drew again. But I mean, you know, you've got this person that works in law enforcement, then it's wow, they're a pilot in law enforcement. That's interesting. Oh, by the way, they dive with sharks and all this kind of thing too. So many areas there. But again, the parallels when we're talking about excellence, yeah. And you know, what's the right word of saying? Fuck, I'm going to have to edit that out now. What am I trying to say?
You're on a roll.
Yeah, I know. I was doing really well. We got to 1:36. All right. And the minute margin for error when it comes to mistakes in what you do is the same for us. We push the wrong drug on a child and they're dead. So, so many parallels between the expertise that you have and a lot of the people listening. So I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time today and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Thank you, James. Thank you for everything you do, man. We really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.